Hi there. I haven't been online in a little while, and it occurred to me, there's been a lot of thoughts going through my head about what this talk should be about. I just want to touch base with you. What's been happening is really exciting. Thanks to contributions and a very notable one from Frank Dixon, I was able to hire some people, have a foundation built, and a metal building built to my specifications. And I have been hard at work for the last few months, creating the first ever Buddhist school for the quantum light Buddhism, teachings. And I'm still working on it. I soon hope to upload a video of the new Kwon. I have been uploading pictures if you've been keeping up with me on my various sites on Google. Appreciate your feedback if you have any. But that's why I haven't been online. Been super busy, working hard, doing everything from plumbing to electrical to drywall work, framing, blah 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 blah, construction, and I'm doing it all alone. So if you live anywhere around here and you want to give me a hand, I sure would appreciate it. But at any rate, I didn't want to just come on and drop a video like this just to excuse myself and to announce the building of the Kwon. But there's been questions coming up recently amongst my emails and amongst people I've been talking to. Is what's up with this Buddhism and these different sects? And what does any of that have to do with what I always hear from you, Sifu Sylvain, and others, and as I read, the scholarship of Buddhism? I'm confused. What's the difference? Very, very good question. So I'm going to try to be brief and answer that, and I'll talk about it more in the future. And if you have any questions, Adam, beneath this video, I'll get a notification and I'll do my best to answer them. And that will help others who maybe haven't gotten around to asking it. All the information is posted. So the video sort of continues through the comments below the video. Anyway, so most Westerners are pretty familiar with Western religions, everything from Islam to Judaism to Christianity and all the various different what you would call sects in the West. Now that's not the same situation as the sects of Buddhism. And let me try to I'm going to be real simple in my description. And that doesn't mean it won't be accurate, but it'll leave room for more discussion. I don't want to get too in-depth on this. I just want you to get the idea of why this is different. In Western religions, what you generally have is everybody studies from a large book. That book, even though, for instance, the Bible has the Book of Job, the Book of excuse me, too soon after breakfast, I guess. Anyway, it's a compilation of many writings of different authors. And you get them all in one book and you call it the Bible. And it has the Old Testament as well as the New Testament in it. So the books and the words in that Bible cover maybe 1300 years or more, several hundred more. Anyway, the idea is that it's one book. There are some people, I'm trying to simplify here. Same thing with the Quran or the Torah. They are the fundamental books of certain religions. Okay? Now, in Buddhism, this is not the case. Okay? In Buddhism, first of all, Buddhism is based on observable phenomena. So it's far more akin to a science than it is to a religion. And religion doesn't bother with that. There's a lot of mysticism in religion, whatever religion you're talking about. A lot of things are just taken on faith. Okay? They're taken on as a belief that we'll all agree on, like the Virgin Mary, like resurrection, like those kind of things. There's nothing like that in Buddhism. Although, as you read a lot of literature about Buddhism, it sure sounds like there's a lot of deities and hells and heavens and so, but those, you have to understand, are from a completely different cultural understanding of the world. And there are those, don't get me wrong, who are get plenty mysticized with Buddhism as well, but that's not correct. Buddhism was taught in stages by Buddha. Buddha is a man. He walked the earth and he reached enlightenment when he was 30, approximately. And the minute he reached enlightenment, aha, he started telling people who were interested in following him, what enlightenment looked like, what it felt like, what it tasted like, what it was. And his first teaching, which is that oration of what being enlightened felt like, was called the Avatamsaka Sutra, or the Kigon Sutra in Japanese. It's a thick book, and it's a really amazing read. It's very poetic. He uses in his words the imagery of the time. 3,000 years ago, people weren't very literate. The literate class, the people who knew calligraphy and writing and Sanskrit and so forth, they were very privileged. They were the Brahmin class. They were the people who did spent their whole lives just studying. And they were very revered. And then there was everybody else who usually didn't even know how to write their own name. So there was a lot of from the Vedic teachings of 12,000 years ago, there was a lot of colorful ways to explain things. It's allegory. It's just like you can read in the Torah or the Bible or any other writings. Human beings, we use these colorful examples that we can exaggerate and imagine situations that make a teaching more obvious. But sometimes they don't get more obvious. Sometimes they're just really wild and out there. At any rate, some of them get more popular than others. Some get really boring. But the ones that are popular seem to implant themselves in the culture, like Rumpelstiltskin in the West, or Little Red Riding Hood. And name me somebody who doesn't know Little Red Riding Hood. They may not know the whole story, but they know that title. And so a lot of the teachers of the day, not just Buddha, but any teacher, would refer to some of these well-known popular stories to get people engaged and to think in a certain way so that they could explain something new. That can be confusing, admittedly. But the point I want to make here, other than you got to get past the language, is that, again, excuse me, Buddha taught his whole life after that into his 80s. And he spent the good over 40, some estimates are 48 years, he spent teaching to elevate the people's capacity, their ability to understand concepts that are so far out from their understanding at the time that they just, he had to take them little by little, kind of like teaching math. If you were 10 years old and your math teacher in elementary school said, "Okay, today we're going to learn theoretical calculus." Okay. And you start going into the, you might catch a little bit of it, but man, he'd be talking about multiplications and just every manner of manipulation of numbers, and it would just be like speaking in a foreign language, so you wouldn't understand it at all. You first have to have a really good handle on abstract thinking, and before you can think abstractly, you have to understand what it is you're abstracting. So even algebra doesn't make much sense to you at that point. You really need the basics. You need plus, minus, divide, multiply, ratios, Remember? So this is what happened, is Buddha reached enlightenment. Siddhartha reached enlightenment, said, "Oh, I know what Buddhahood is. It's like this calculus." And everybody looked at him like, "Wow. What's that got to do with me?" So he spent like 48 years taking them along step by step by step. And when they graduated junior high and started high school teachings, he said, "Okay, now everything I taught you up to now, really forget it. Don't even use it. I just use that to get you to here. This is the true teaching. Do this." And you'll notice that throughout all of the sutras, at some point he says, "Okay, everything you learned before, just forget it. Think this way now." And what happened was, as the teachings, because they were only transmitted orally for his lifetime and even for a while after, until his son and some other scholars that were intimate with him decided, we need to capture all of this. As well as we remember it, we need to write it down. Because even the Buddha himself said, the people of this generation aren't going to get this. 500 years after I'm dead, someone will come along and reinterpret all of this, not change it, but reinterpret it so that the people of that time, whose capacity is much greater, will be able to understand it. And what will happen is every 500 years after I'm dead, people will become more sophisticated and able to understand these concepts, and they won't need as much weirdness around it to get it. It won't be as hard for them to reach enlightenment because they'll already have a lot of sophistication and education just because of life and evolution. And 1500 years after I'm dead, someone will come along and they will deliver my final teaching, my ultimate teaching, which is the Lotus Sutra. Of course, he didn't teach that final teaching till the last 8 years of his life. So there were a whole bunch of people that learned all these other steps, various steps, but they didn't necessarily get to those last teachings. They didn't hear them. They didn't find the translations of them. And meanwhile, they were traveling to their home countries in Burma and Malaysia and Korea and so forth. And they thought they had the teachings because every time they read the teachings, it said, "Forget what you had before. This is it." So it's like the high school graduate who goes, "I'd like to go to college, but I can't. So I'm going to take my high school education, which has everything that I need, and I'm going to go teach it to everybody." Okay? That is a sect in Buddhism. You see how different that is? A sect in the West is anybody who takes that whole Bible or that whole Torah or that whole Quran and they reinterpret it to the way they like to see it, and they call everybody else's interpretation wrong. And they say, "I'm right. They're bad, we're good." And that's how you get sectioning sects in the West. What happens in the East, with Buddhism specifically, is that you have people who just take a chunk of the teachings and say, "This is it." And then you get the college graduate who goes, "Those high school people, they don't understand fully. You have to practice this." But they don't deny any of what the high school people know, because you need to know that to get this. You see what I'm saying? It's very different. It's inclusive. Although there are plenty of arguments in Buddhism too, but I'm trying to simplify so you understand this conceptually. And it's not until much later that the final teachings really reach a broad audience. Well, now, when that starts to happen, the people who are researching Buddhism all the way to Buddha's day are saying, "Well, we have to get this in a chronological order because the people who are high school and the people who are college and the people who are Lotus Sutra, they're all going to argue amongst each other. They don't know what they're talking about unless they understand this timeline." So yet another evolution happens. And this happens in China, not even in India. In fact, India was banned, one of the great kings of India banned Buddhism throughout India. the place of its birth. So there's a lot of politics, a lot of history to all of this, and there's two imperatives I have to leave you with. A, Buddha said, study, 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 and when you're done studying, study some more. His thing was that if you get to the ultimate teaching, the Lotus Sutra here, and you study all of the myriad teachings of Buddhism, even the really weird stuff where people just went off on the, who knows, they still, and he said, not just Buddhist teachings, non-Buddhist as well. Because what he was saying is ultimately, if you spend your life studying for your personal growth, your retraining of your mind, sooner or later you're going to get to this enlightenment. Because, and this is what he reveals in the Lotus Sutra, that none of the other previous stages of Buddhahood or of his teachings did. In the Lotus Sutra is where he finally said, and people of today are the people who should get this the most. Your enlightenment is already there. You already are enlightenment. The only thing that's preventing you from existing within that realm of enlightenment, Buddhahood, we call it, is your human condition, because your human condition is completely based on desire. The reason that you're born as a human is because you desire to be. And everything that desires to be is about possession and ownership. And this is where all suffering comes from. It's the first law of Buddhism. Life is suffering. All life. Because it's descendant, it's created by desire. And desire, the ego is the desire machine, really is protective of itself. So it creates all sorts of devices for us to cling to this idea of self and me-ness and Bob-ness and Joan-ness and Peter-ness, whatever. And it's hard. It's really hard to pierce through that because our ego does not want to let it go. But when you hear about lifetimes, this will be throughout all the teaching. When you hear about lifetimes and 16 million eons and all this stuff, it all happens within your lifetime, right now, this moment. We talk a lot in Buddhism about moments, how you experience 3,000 realms in each moment of life, how you have 180,000 psychological decisions you make in each moment of life. This all sounds abstract, but the point is, you see, our civilization now is so scientifically advanced that we know that a moment, our life, or back up again, I'm doing the same thing. In math, you remember when you learned that about a point? A point is a location, but it's not a thing. And a line is a series of discrete points, all one after another. This is the same way Buddha described life. Life is a process, and we exist moment to moment, independent, discrete moment, 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 moment. You can't, and he called it a moment because it's a non-scientific division of time. You can't measure it. It's just we know that we go from moment to moment to moment. And each of those moments, those discrete moments, whether you want to call it an angstrom second, a nanosecond, whatever you're comfortable with, it doesn't matter because the point, haha, is they're individual points. Our life isn't a stream, an indivisible stream. Our life is a stream, like a line, made up of individual points. And each of those points is a birth and a death, a birth and a death, a birth and a death, and a birth and a death. And each birth carries over some information from the previous death, and so on. This is what gives us our illusion of a cohesive oneness, thingness. Now, if that sounds mystic, you need to study more math because it's really, it's scientifically observable. And again, Buddhism isn't about mysticism, it's about observable phenomena. So I hope this helps. Scholarship, I'll just for a brief minute, because I know I'm going long here. Scholarship is basically the retrospective study, like all scholarship is, of how did we get here from there? And Buddhism, from its get-go, has been obsessed with precision. And so you get people like Nagarjuna, 400 years after, 400 or 500 years after the Buddha's passing, who comes out and he hears a lot of this stuff about the soul. And he researches it and goes, Buddha, what are you people talking about? See, people gravitate to what they know and they slowly incorporate it into things and they muck it up. So scholarship says, no. Buddha was very adamant about impermanence. Nothing has permanence. Nothing. There is no atom called Sylvain. There is no atom called you or any part of you. Yet ultimately, we're not thingness. We're noumena, not phenomena. And because of that, there can be no such thing as a soul, a hefty trash bag full of, cause and effect or characteristics. There's no bag of Bob. I know I use Bob a lot, but that name kind of kicks me. Anyway, do you see what I mean? There can't possibly be a soul, and Buddha made sure it's called Anatman. Atman is having this kind of thing of like a soul, where you carry along this bag of, whoever you are, and Anatman is the reality of non-soul. So that means you have to resolve birth and death differently, doesn't it? It means there is no real you. There is only the cause of what you make with what you think is you. Yourself is an illusion you make up to bolster yourself, to keep your desires going. And because we're a desire machine, that's why we fear death. But there's no reason to fear death because it's no different than this. So, sects are stages of learning in Buddhism, and scholarship is making sure the precision remains, that we always come back to square one, that everything aligns. And if it doesn't, it ain't Buddhism. Make sense? I hope that helps. I'm going to stop this because I'm over 20 minutes. I enjoyed talking to you. I miss talking to you guys. And I hope to finish the koan soon. And then we're going to have real regular weekly videos, as I have talks every week on Buddhism. And I hope that you'll be able to participate more. Okay? Have a great day. Love you guys. Bye.